Welcome to the debate. Imagine you are walking across a vast frozen lake.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right. You see this path marked with bright orange flags, and the authorities have placed a sign that says, you know, walk here, this path is approved.
So obviously you followed the flags.
Exactly. You follow the flags, assuming the ice is thickest exactly where they are placed. But what if those flags don't actually mark the thickest ice? What if they merely mark the only path a corporation paid millions of dollars to measure?
Right. And what if, just a few feet away, there is ice that is 10 times thicker, walked on for centuries even, but unflagged simply because no one owns the rights to it? I mean, it forces us to ask a rather uncomfortable question. Are we trusting the ice, or are we merely trusting the flags?
Precisely. And that frozen lake is exactly how Sidney J. Hubbard views the modern medical landscape in his recent analytical work on what he calls the approval category error. We tend to assume that FDA-approved drugs are the definitively safe, flagged path.
Which is a huge assumption.
It is. But today we are unpacking a critical question raised by Hubbard's framework. Does FDA regulatory approval status actually function as a reliable proxy for comparative biological safety? Or does it commit a foundational category error that systematically blinds us to real human risk?
It really is a fascinating text. It forces us to look at the invisible structures governing what we consider safe, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And we will be exploring this by looking at the theoretical architecture of drug approval, as well as a really fascinating comparative data analysis from the text involving the veterinary dewormer fenbendazole and everyday ibuprofen.
Yes, the ibuprofen comparison is wild.
It really is. Now, looking at Hubbard's framework, my perspective is that the FDA approval process, despite its very real limitations, is the most robust mechanism we have for translating terrifying biological uncertainty into quantified, manageable risk. It is, well, an essential heuristic for human safety.
Right. And I look at that exact same framework and see that conflating regulatory approval with biological safety is a dangerous structural mistake.
Dangerous?
Yes, a dangerous category error, because it systematically masks the residual unknown risks of novel patented drugs while simultaneously, you know, hiding the established historical safety of unapproved public domain substances.
Okay, to really get into this, I think we need to unpack how Hubbard actually defines safety and uncertainty. Because in clinical medicine, safety isn't just about whether a substance is toxic in a vacuum, right?
Right. It's highly contextual.
Exactly. It is about the precise quantification of risk within a very specific context. Hubbard provides a taxonomy that breaks biological uncertainty down into five distinct categories. Let's actually explain how these work.
Go for it.
First, you have intrinsic uncertainty, so what the molecule fundamentally does. Then regimen uncertainty.
Meaning what happens when you take exactly, say, 20 milligrams every day for 6 months?
Spot on. Then you have efficacy uncertainty, product manufacturing uncertainty, and patient variation uncertainty.
Right. It is a very granular way of looking at what we don't know.
Precisely. And my position is that a clinical trial is designed to systematically eliminate those specific uncertainties. Take product manufacturing, for example. Without a regulatory framework, you don't actually know if the pill you take on Tuesday has the exact same concentration of active ingredient as the pill you take on Friday.
Sure, quality control is important.
Right, and the FDA approval process forces manufacturers to lock that down. It takes this terrifying expanse of unknown biological dangers and turns them into visible, measurable, and controllable data points. Without this rigorous regulatory enclosure, clinicians and patients are left operating entirely in the dark.
But are they really in the dark?
I mean, yes. While the approval label might be a compression of incredibly complex data, it acts as the only responsible baseline we have for determining comparative safety in a high-stakes clinical environment.
I hear you, but the problem with using that baseline as your ultimate heuristic is that it forces two completely independent biological realities into a single binary label. Hubbard defines the core category error as the mistake of treating regulatory status as a general ranking of biological safety.
Okay, break that down a bit more.
Sure. To explain why this is a mistake, Hubbard introduces two independent safety axes. The first is the R axis, which stands for regimen-specific regulatory evidence. This is your clinical trial data, highly controlled, looking at a specific dose, route, and measured benefit for one specific disease.
Which is incredibly valuable data.
It is. It absolutely is. But it is incomplete without the second axis, which is H.
Cumulative human exposure.
Exactly. Cumulative human exposure evidence. This is the messy real-world data, the sheer number of human beings exposed to a substance over elapsed time, which allows us to observe long latency outcomes across history.
Right. Basically, how many people have taken it over how many years?
Right. My point is that a novel, newly approved drug may have incredibly high R. You know, it passed its three phases of clinical trials flawlessly, but a terribly shallow H. Because it was invented 5 years ago, it retains a massive horizon of unknown adverse effects. It's brand new to the human species.
While older drugs...
Conversely, a historically familiar public domain substance may have deep, historically familiar H, meaning millions of humans have safely processed it. But it has low R for a new therapeutic use because no one ran a trial. Forcing these two distinct axes into a single FDA-approved label impedes genuine informed consent. It structurally biases the entire medical system against cheap, widely available compounds.
Well, I think to really test that theory, we need to ground this in the empirical data from the source material. The text provides a direct acute toxicity comparison between fenbendazole, which is an unapproved veterinary dewormer that has recently sparked, you know, immense interest in alternative medicine, and ibuprofen, a drug sitting in nearly every medicine cabinet in the world.
Yes, and this specific comparison is where the flaw in the approval heuristic becomes glaringly obvious. I come at it from a different way when I look at this data. If we want to talk about biological safety, let's look at the raw oral LD50.
Which is the median lethal dose.
Right. For those unfamiliar, the amount required to kill 50% of a test population in acute single-dose tests. Fenbendazole has an oral LD50 of greater than 10,000 milligrams per kilogram. In toxicological terms, it is practically non-toxic acutely. You could swallow a massive amount of it, and acutely, it is relatively harmless.
In rats, to be clear.
In rats, yes. But now let's look at FDA-approved ibuprofen. Its oral LD50 in rats is roughly 636 milligrams per kilogram. That makes ibuprofen roughly 15 to 16 times more toxic acutely than fenbendazole.
Wow, that is a stark difference.
And we aren't just relying on animal models here, right? We have massive human data showing that ibuprofen carries well-documented risks. We know it causes gastrointestinal bleeding, acute kidney injury, and cardiovascular events. It has a documented rate of drug-induced liver injury, about 1 to 1.6 cases per 100,000 prescriptions.
Right.
Yet, under the FDA paradigm, ibuprofen is universally communicated to the public as safer, simply because it possesses that regulatory label. Treating ibuprofen as inherently safer completely ignores the raw biological reality of the respective toxicities.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Ibuprofen is functionally safer in a clinical setting precisely because those risks you just listed, the GI bleeds, the 1 to 1.6 cases of liver injury per 100,000 prescriptions, are known.
Because they're known?
Yes, they are mathematically quantified. And because we have that data, we can mitigate the harm. We can establish clear dosing limits. We can place warnings for high-risk groups, like the elderly or those with renal impairment, and we can monitor for specific outcomes. With fenbendazole, its chronic human safety profile is effectively a blank page, outside of, you know, a handful of case reports showing idiosyncratic liver injury.
A blank page because nobody will fund the studies.
But let me offer an analogy here to explain why the LD50 isn't enough. Relying on a high LD50 without indication-specific clinical trials is like trusting a bridge just because you know the concrete is incredibly thick. An FDA-approved drug, on the other hand, is a bridge that has undergone rigorous, highly specific stress testing.
Okay, but...
We know exactly how much weight it can take before it breaks, what weather conditions it can withstand, and exactly where the microscopic fractures will form.
In medicine, being able to say, we know this causes X problem in Y out of 100,000 people is fundamentally safer than saying, we have almost no idea how often it causes serious problems with repeated long-term use.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why your bridge analogy fundamentally misrepresents the landscape we're dealing with.
Oh?
It assumes that the bridges chosen for stress testing are selected based on their potential utility to the public or their underlying structural promise. They are not. We only stress test the bridges that corporations can charge a toll on.
That's a pretty cynical view.
It's what the source material explicitly outlines, what it calls the intellectual property and financing enclosure.
Meaning the cost barrier to entry?
Exactly. Running those large confirmatory clinical trials, preparing the regulatory submissions, and funding continuing post-market surveillance requires hundreds of millions of dollars. Patent protection and commercial exclusivity are literally the only mechanisms in our current system that make that expenditure recoverable.
Sure, clinical research is expensive.
Very. So widely available off-patent substances, like fenbendazole, or older public domain chemicals, simply do not offer that financial return. The text cites a 2025 life cycle analysis, which found that limited financial support for confirmatory trials reduced the likelihood of successful FDA authorization for repurposed off-patent drugs to below 30%.
Right, the 30% stat.
Therefore, the lack of FDA approval for a widely available public domain substance isn't proof that the concrete is weak or that it is biologically unsafe. It simply means no one possesses the financial incentive to monetize proving that it works. Comparing a cheap, unpatentable compound's lack of approval to a novel patented drug's approval as a measure of biological safety is the textbook definition of the category error. You aren't measuring safety, you are measuring patentability.
Look, I acknowledge the economic reality of the pharmaceutical pipeline. It is undeniably driven by financial incentives. And yes, that creates a filter. But that doesn't negate the empirical value of the regulatory enclosure that the financing produces.
It biases it, though.
Perhaps. But furthermore, I think portraying this purely as a toll bridge monopoly ignores the alternative pathways the FDA has actually built to address this very issue. The FDA offers the 505(b)(2) pathway, for instance.
Yes, but...
Let me just explain it.
This pathway specifically allows applicants to rely heavily on existing published literature and historical data for new indications of known substances, which significantly reduces the cost of trials. There's also the orphan drug designation, which provides 7 years of market exclusivity to incentivize research into rare diseases, even if you don't hold a traditional composition of matter patent.
But even the 505(b)(2) pathway requires massive investment in chemistry, manufacturing, and controls, the CMC requirements. You still have to pay millions to prove manufacturing scale-up. You do, because manufacturing scale-up is where contamination happens. The barrier isn't just some conspiracy of patents. It is that someone still has to do the heavy lifting of ensuring good manufacturing practices and managing the regulatory package so patients don't get poisoned by impurities.
I'm not arguing for impurities.
And we cannot dismiss the necessity of the rigorous testing this system demands, even if the funding model is imperfect. Consider carcinogenicity studies. The material points out that we still don't fully understand the mechanistic reasons why one cell becomes cancerous and another does not. The underlying biology is incredibly opaque.
Very true.
Yet empirical carcinogenicity studies testing whether long-term exposure increases tumor rates in animals successfully flagged massive human threats like asbestos, benzene, and aflatoxins. But I really have to push back on your critique of the financial enclosure here. If we abandon the financial incentive that drives the FDA pipeline because we view it as inherently biased against cheap compounds, how on earth do we fund the massive multi-year empirical studies required to discover rare, delayed, or idiosyncratic reactions? Who pays for the stress testing if we remove the toll?
Okay, you are defending the necessity of the evidence, which I don't dispute. Of course we need rigorous evidence and manufacturing standards. I am critiquing the illusion of safety that is projected onto the substances that manage to secure that funding.
The illusion of safety?
Yes. Let's talk about those rare, delayed, or idiosyncratic reactions you just mentioned, because this is where the category error does real harm. The current system falsely projects safety onto novel drugs precisely because they have FDA approval. But novelty preserves an irreducible exposure time boundary.
Meaning we haven't watched them long enough.
Exactly. The text cites a vital study on this. Out of 222 novel therapeutics approved from 2001 to 2010, 71 acquired a post-market safety event over a median follow-up of 11.7 years.
71 out of 222.
Yes, that is nearly a third of all approved novel drugs exhibiting new, significant safety issues after they were deemed safe by the regulatory body. Another study of 219 newly approved small molecule drugs identified 11 full safety withdrawals and 30 post-market boxed warnings that were simply not discernible from the pre-market review data. This brings us directly to Hubbard's Level 3 nested causal model.
Okay, let's explain what that means for the audience, because nested causal model sounds incredibly dense.
It sounds dense, but it's actually pretty intuitive. A nested causal model just means human biology is a series of complex, interacting systems nested within each other. Cells within tissues, within organs, within environments. A clinical trial only tests a tiny controlled slice of that causality.
Right, the R-axis.
Because human biology is so complex, any novel drug carries a massive horizon of unknowns that only reveal themselves over decades of broad human use. Hubbard defines our current regulatory paradigm as state A.
Okay.
In state A, regulatory approval substitutes for comparative safety. State A fundamentally corrupts informed consent. It tells the patient, this novel drug is approved, therefore it is safe, completely hiding the residual unknown risk horizon that exists simply because the drug is new to the human species.
Where's the older drug?
Meanwhile, a historically familiar substance, like our fenbendazole's example, may have a much smaller, unknown common effect horizon because millions of mammals, and historically many humans, have processed similar compounds. Yet it is labeled unsafe simply because it lacks the toll bridge funding for a new indication.
That's an interesting point, though. I would frame it differently.
How so?
The fact that 71 out of 222 novel therapeutics acquired a post-market safety event doesn't mean the system falsely projects safety. It actually proves the FDA system is working exactly as intended.
Working as intended by finding out a drug is dangerous 10 years later?
By demonstrating that the regulatory framework adapts as each cumulative human exposure grows. The FDA explicitly recognizes that complete, perfect safety information is impossible at the moment of approval. That is a stated boundary of pre-market evidence, not some hidden defect discovered outside the regulatory system.
But the public doesn't know that.
Well, let's look at the practical application of Hubbard's alternative. He proposes what he calls state B, where a drug's approval status, its R-axis, and its exposure history, its H-axis, are disclosed independently to the patient.
Right, the separating the vectors of evidence.
But think about how that plays out clinically. In high-stakes, terrifying situations like an oncology ward, doesn't presenting state B place an impossible cognitive burden on a patient?
I don't think it's impossible.
Well, imagine a patient with aggressive cancer is told, treatment X has rigorous indication-specific trials proving it shrinks your tumor, but unknown long-term risks, while treatment Y has centuries of general human exposure showing it's well-tolerated, but absolutely no proof it treats your specific cancer. I mean, how is a patient supposed to navigate that? Doesn't the approval heuristic, flawed and compressed as it may be, serve a vital function by protecting vulnerable people from speculative, unproven treatments that might just be riding the coattails of their high LD50s?
I think it is deeply paternalistic to assume that patients cannot comprehend the difference between we haven't studied this enough and this is biologically dangerous. The cognitive burden argument is exactly what sustains what Hubbard calls the communication enclosure.
Meaning how we talk about drugs to the public.
Yes. Public communication favors simple binary categories, safe versus unsafe, approved versus unapproved. The communication enclosure means we slap the FDA-approved label on a drug and all the nuanced, missing data about long-term risks just gets swept under the rug.
Is it really swept under the rug, though?
For the patient, absolutely. A nationally representative survey of 1,744 U.S. adults cited in the text found substantial misperceptions about what FDA oversight actually means. a huge portion of the public believes approval guarantees absolute safety. When a symbol predictably communicates more than its technical definition, that is a structural failure of the system. Informed consent legally and ethically requires the disclosure of material risks, potential benefits, alternatives, and relevant uncertainty. If the approval status conceals the greater historical exposure of one substance or conceals the greater residual novelty of another, the patient is not receiving the actual structure of uncertainty. They are receiving an institutional shortcut.
But they need a shortcut sometimes.
Hubrick isn't arguing that historical use proves efficacy or that patients should abandon established standards of care. He is arguing that the impediment to true informed consent arises when a true regulatory statement, "This drug is approved," encloses and entirely displaces the unanswered biological questions. The category error ends where the complete comparison begins. We have to trust patients with the full picture.
Well, this has been a profoundly illuminating exchange, and it has certainly sharpened my view on the nuances of the source material. While I hear your concerns about the communication enclosure, and I agree we need better transparency, I must reiterate my position on the utility of the FDA framework.
Fair enough.
The financial structures behind FDA approval undeniably limit which substances get studied. The pipeline is heavily biased toward the patentable. However, the regimen-specific certainty that the FDA process provides, methodically reducing the intrinsic, regimen, and efficacy uncertainties into quantified, manageable data, remains the most powerful and responsible tool we have for making informed medical decisions. A heuristic is a simplification by definition. It leaves some data out. But in the fragile, high-stakes realm of human health, a stress-tested bridge, even one that requires a toll, is vastly safer than walking on untested ice.
And I must reiterate that uncollapsing this category error is vital for the intellectual and practical future of medicine. We cannot continue to treat a lack of patentability as a synonym for biological danger. Regulatory history, the R-axis, and cumulative human exposure, the H-axis, must be treated as distinct vectors of evidence.
Even if it complicates the clinical conversation.
Especially then. Until we structurally separate them in our clinical communication, we will continue to overestimate the safety of novel proprietary molecules and vastly underinvestigate the latent therapeutic potential of the public domain. Patients deserve the true, complex architecture of uncertainty, not a financial filter masquerading as a biological truth.
We will have to acknowledge our continued disagreement on whether the FDA approval heuristic ultimately does more harm than good in everyday clinical practice. But I think we absolutely agree that the source material demands a much more nuanced, precise vocabulary for discussing risk, evidence, and uncertainty in medicine.
Completely. Unpacking these systemic enclosures deeply enriches our understanding of medical science. It reveals that what we so often accept as pristine scientific certainty is, in reality, deeply influenced by legal boundaries, economic incentives, and institutional constraints. It challenges us to look closer at the data itself.
There is so much more to explore in the complex architecture of evidence and safety. The text really invites a complete paradigm shift in how we read medical data. It leaves us to wonder, the next time we find ourselves standing at the edge of that frozen lake, looking at the orange flags, wait, are we truly seeing the safest path, or just the only path we've been allowed to see? Thank you for listening to The Debate.